All right, welcome back to the Beyond Sunday podcast. We're exploring how to take our faith beyond Sunday morning. This is Patrick Nazaroff with me, as always, Pastor Bowser.
How are we doing, Patrick?
And Lisa McCarter.
Still here. Still pretty successful.
Great job last week. Sorry I missed it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How do you know it was a great job?
Yeah, considering it did not come out on time. and I know
you didn't listen to it.
I know you did a great job. I just know.
I appreciate your confidence.
That's a nice faith in us.
When I walked into the room, I felt good things happened in here.
As opposed to like walking into a haunted mansion and feeling like bad spirits in the room.
Sure.
Tell everybody about the boiler.
Yeah, I did read the other day that when you feel uneasy in like old homes, it is because of the boiler.
Okay.
That's not necessarily ghosts.
Okay.
It's like a frequency thing that you can't hear in
the pipes that you cannot physically hear, but you can feel and sense.
There was also that for a long time people had those certain lamps in their house, and basically everyone was getting carbon monoxide poisoning, and that was probably causing hallucinations where they would see ghosts and things like that.
Yeah, that's so no good, but
that's a good combination.
They gave us some gnarly stories.
And lead in the paint.
And lead in the paint and arsenic in the makeup.
Yeah, destroying our brains.
Yeah.
Copper pots.
But we got ghosts from it, so that's cool.
People still see ghosts. And goats.
Goats.
I see goats on a fairly regular basis.
I love goats. Love a goat story.
I held a baby goat last week on vacation.
Yeah.
Aww. Y'all were in here. I was probably holding a baby goat.
I thought it wasn't vacation.
It's not vacation when you have kids.
Yeah. That's true. No. I asked him how vacation was, and he was like, I wasn't on vacation.
It was a trip.
It was
time away from work.
Yeah.
Whether or not you want to call that a vacation.
Yeah. Now I'm back at work, and I'm like, finally. you get some rest.
Nap at your desk.
Well, I'm just saying it's easier than courting my kids around, keeping them entertained. So,
In a strange place.
In a strange place, yeah.
But you got to hold a baby goat.
But I didn't get to hold a baby goat.
Yeah.
Did you hold a baby goat last week?
Not that I remember.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah. There you go. All right, let's get to our news. If you're looking for a new job.
Oh. I'm not.
Or a job.
I'm good. Yeah.
New York-based pet food company is posting two unusual job postings.
Okay.
Spot and Tango is seeking to fill two contracted positions. One, dog breath sniffer.
Nope.
I'm out. 100% out. Hate everything about that.
Yeah.
Even the sentence.
Dog breath sniffer.
Are you obsessed with dogs? You have a nose that can detect even the faintest hint of funk.
Yes, but I'm not obsessed with dogs.
Not for you, yeah. Yes to both of those for me. Although you did get a dog this year, and that's like one of my favorite things that's happened to you.
Okay, first off, having a dog does not equal obsessed with dogs.
And I know, you're not obsessed.
I can smell her nasty breath across a room. I don't need to be a professional tester for
this. The reason I'm happy about it is because you're disgruntled by it. It just feels like...
I'm glad that you take joy in my disgruntlement.
I know Amanda's really excited about the dog.
Amanda loves the dog. Yeah. The dog is very sweet. I have zero problems with the dog. That does not mean that I'm the one who wanted the dog.
he says convincingly.
Well, for the job, you need to do some close-up breath assessments.
I know.
Keeping meticulous notes and collaborating with canine focus groups.
There is no animal, human or otherwise, that I would want to professionally smell their breath.
So you're in the service of their subsidiary, Pop Gum, which is the company's breath freshening dental chews.
Pop Gum? Is it supposed to be a play on Top Gun or Pop Tart or what's happening?
There's too Pop many... Gum.
Yeah, I understand what it was. I was trying to understand.
Pop Gum.
Pop Gum.
That makes more sense. Yeah. It sounded like Top Gun, but not quite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a little bit like Pop Tart, but not quite.
Pop Gum.
Pop Gum.
The other job, if sniffing their breath isn't good for you,
if it's the other end, it's getting worse.
Yeah.
And this is a dog kisser.
Nope.
Smooching dogs.
Nope.
This one, if your friends describe you as the one who always ends up with a dog on their lap, this role was made for you.
On my lap is not the same
as in my mouth.
The pooch smoocher. Yeah. You'll rate and document dog kisses with professional rigor and personal enthusiasm.
Professional rigor.
Nope. I don't like anything about this.
I have not told you how much this pays.
How much?
Not enough.
It's paying more than enough. I can tell you that.
What does it pay?
$1,000 an hour.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
Yeah. I'll sniff the other end.
Yeah. Do I need to lick the other end? It's on the table.
For $1,000 an hour. Yeah. Dog smoocher, with or without tongue. Because neither is a deal breaker.
Do we need to maintain eye contact?
All right. This is getting weird. I don't like this conversation anymore.
$1,000 an hour?
Yeah, how many hours are we doing this for? Yeah. Is travel expense included?
Commute in. Yeah.
Right. Are there benefits?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's pretty crazy. Spot and Tango. I mean, obviously, I think you just say that so that you can get some national news media associated with your thing. But still, $1,000 an hour mm-hmm. to sniff the dog's breath and kiss it.
Wait, both? You have to do both of them?
No.
One or the other.
Yeah.
But they're both $1,000 an
hour. They're both $1,000 an hour. It feels like that's one job. Come on.
Kissing.
Maybe it's like a 1 hour, one time gig. Like
yeah, I bet. I bet it's a contracted thing. You're only going to do it for like a couple weeks and, you know, only, yeah.
But like two dogs in there.
And I bet it's like up to $1,000 an hour.
Mm. Probably. Yeah. It probably starts at $20 an hour. Yeah.
But would you willing to work with that? Yeah. If you have previous experience in the area.
Yeah, I do. I worked at a dog training facility for years.
You could get at least $30 to $40 an hour for that.
What do you think you're more qualified here? Sniffer or kisser?
Sniffer. I could be a sommelier.
I am absolutely not qualified for either of them. I am completely unqualified. No one should consider putting me forward.
I have a pretty poor sense of smell, so I would be a dog kisser, I think. So.
Okay.
Kissing's not my favorite, you know? Like...
Yeah.
I'm like, let's hold hands. Let's snuggle.
Sure.
Like,
yeah. you're like Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman for $1,000 an hour.
Yeah, kissing, no kissing.
No kissing.
Kissing off the table. Everything else is fine. Yeah.
Okay. We're making a lot of leaps here.
People have seen Pretty Woman. It's fine.
I'm referencing
I understand they've
Julia
seen it.
Roberts.
I'm just saying. Yeah.
Saying, you know?
Just because we understand it doesn't mean it needs to be said. That's
okay.
You made a movie reference before the podcast.
You did.
Ghost.
Ghost.
Before the podcast. We say all sorts of things before the podcast.
All right. Well, if you're interested, if you're a listener interested, please apply and let us know.
You say I had to go to New York?
To New York. New York based.
Hmm.
Does it say where in New York? Because New York City, upstate, very different places.
This feels like a city position.
It does.
This is not an upstate position.
$1,000 an hour, you're going to be in the city.
$1,000 an hour doesn't go very far in New York City.
Well, no, but.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. Spot and Tango, if you're interested.
This is a dog food company, Spot and Tango?
It is a dog food company
that
are launching Pup Gum.
Pup Gum. So. And doggy kisses.
Where do we apply?
I think you
SpotandTango.com.
Spot and Tango, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Maybe Spot and Tango want to sponsor this podcast.
Maybe. Let's reach out.
Or, you know, look, can I work from home?
You know, like, a remote dog sniffer?
I guess you got to be in because the dog has to eat the gum first.
Yeah.
You got to get it before and after.
Or they have to send you the gum and you have to like walk up to strangers and be like, can I give your dog this gum and then sniff its breath?
Yeah, let us know how that goes.
I'm like, you got to talk to a stranger.
Maybe I'm
out on the $1,000. Right.
I'll split the thousand with you. I'll talk to the stranger and you give the dog the gum and sniff it.
I'll tell you this: if they're going to send me $1,000 an hour to do this at home, they're going to get a lot of data. It might all be fake, but I'll fill it all out.
I will generate some data.
I'll generate lots of data. Very affirming of their pup gum.
Yeah. Right.
That'll be exactly what they were hoping to hear.
Yes. They don't know that. All right. Let's jump into our main topic.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're in a new month.
We're in a new month. I got a script here for us.
Happy May.
Yeah. Happy
is
May.
Is it May?
Oh. It will be when this podcast comes out.
It's going to be May.
There you go. Yes. Nailed it.
April showers have brought May flowers. Yes.
Yep. Yeah. We're supposed to get more showers this weekend, so that's probably true.
Yeah, it's supposed to be cool again this weekend.
This weekend is May.
Well, shucks.
Oh, well.
Or this past weekend, actually. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do Mayflowers bring? Pilgrims.
Yep. I was like, wait, I heard this.
All right. So that means we're back in the Bible.
Woo.
The Bible.
Another hard topics of the Bible, hard sections of the Bible. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we have an official title.
Nah.
Maybe we did.
Things of the Bible.
Things of the Bible.
Hard stuff in the Bible.
That we want to talk about.
That we want to talk about, yeah. and so we're going to kind of look at the difficulty reconciling the violence of the Old Testament, kind of especially in contrast with some of Jesus' commandments in the Sermon on the Mount.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, okay.
Because it's not, it does kind of have, you know, obviously the Old and New Testament take place in different time periods, different kind of theologies present.
Yes.
But it is kind of a hard pivot of kind of what seems to be totally on board in the OT and now a truly new commandment in the NT. So
that's some good slang there to really.
Yeah.
OT, NT.
Yeah. All right. So. What do you think? Is there tension here for you between these two things?
I mean, I've wrestled with it for a long time, so I think I've come to a place where I'm pretty comfortable with it, but I definitely can understand and hear people when they talk about the tension. So I don't like live every day going like, oh my God, these things don't align. But I get it. I've wrestled with it in the past. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's similar. Like I see, like I've heard people say that the Bible contradicts itself in this way, right? Mm-hmm. Which I understand and actually do not think with like a faithful reading of it that it contradicts itself. Mm-hmm. But I definitely understand like where that comes from. To me, that's actually one of the more believable instances of like supposed contradiction than some of the others, you know?
Sure. Yeah. This idea that like there was a way that God expected us to act here and now there's a different way that God expects us to act feels contradictory.
It does.
Contrary.
Yeah.
Was it? Yeah. Contradictory. Contrary.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a reasonable instinct, but I think that comes surface level feels demeaning, and I don't mean it that way, but it comes from like a glossed over reading of like, well, this is the story, this is
for
the story,
sure.
Without
yeah.
going into what's behind either of those and what's happening beyond that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will kind of get into some story ideas, you know, that are present in the Old Testament. I mean, we can say with certainty, it's got a lot of violence.
Sure.
From both global to nation to individual, you know, so like there's just a tremendous amount there.
Yeah.
And what is happening in the New Testament is a little different. It's just, it's from a different point of view.
Sure.
And a different audience and a different, some of my different ideas kind of being present there. So I do understand, yeah, maybe as Elise mentioned, like a tension. I don't necessarily think it is a contradiction, but you know, I do get it if that, if you find that.
Yep.
All right, so let's talk about the Old Testament.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite violent story in the Old Testament?
Oh, a favorite violent story.
I do have a favorite violent story.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you guys have one?
Yeah, of course.
Well, let me think about it.
Okay. Well, you're on the clock.
Okay.
You want us to tell our stories first?
Go with yours first. I mean, I have stuff that I think of.
Yeah.
But
mine is the story of Jael driving a tent peg through
the
king's
head. Oh, it's so good.
Head.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
It's great. So there's a king who's running away from the Israelite army.
Yeah.
Jael brings him into her tent, and he asks her to protect him. She gives him milk, which is probably some sort of alcohol. He passes out, and she drives a tent peg.
Get
through
it, girl.
His head. Yeah.
There's not a thing wrong with this story. No notes. No contradiction. This is peak Bible right here.
It's good stuff. Yeah. That's probably my favorite go-to violent story in the Bible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, a good one is the prophet Elisha is walking. He gets mocked, and some bears come out of the woods and rip apart the youths that are mocking him.
Yeah. Yeah. For being bald.
For being bald.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You're on notice, youths. Yeah. Your bald jokes.
Youths.
Yeah, that's definitely one that I like. I also kind of like, you know, there's, you know, in the judges' stories,
judges,
I think, are all
some,
kind of
yeah.
interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I do like that Samson, you know, is seduced by an obvious woman who's against him and keeps giving her false information because she's really, really pretty. And then he would wake up bound by like leather, rip it apart, and then like murder everyone in the room and then goes back to her that next night.
Yeah.
You know, in these kind
of happens like multiple times.
Multiple times. So Elise, what you got?
I mean, I think Esther's kind of a classic one that comes to mind for me. Like the king is planning to put to death like this entire people group, but she's so hot that she convinces him not to.
Sure. She also
really
prays, but that's
powerful,
cool. Yeah.
Power move there. Like, I'm so pretty.
I mean,
she's not going to kill everybody.
She's so pretty, she becomes queen. That's for
that
sure.
That too,
how she
And it's like explicitly a beauty contest.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
Yeah. No, that's a good one. It's it's does have a flip between Haman and Mordecai.
Yeah, and then they hang Haman. Right, the dude that was like
conspiring,
trying to,
it's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, Esther is a good story.
It is a good story. It's weird, but
You know, here's some of the highlights that I kind of pulled from here of violence in the Old Testament. The conquest of Canaan.
Sure.
So this is going to take place in the book of Joshua, and this is the Israelites after escaping slavery. They've wandered through the desert. They've gotten there with Moses. We covered kind of the 10 plagues on a previous edition of this theme.
Yeah, we've also done the book of Exodus once upon a time.
And the book of Joshua, I think.
Yeah,
so
we're way back there.
Yeah.
Check out the archives, folks.
You can, oh my gosh.
But basically, they arrive to this the promised land, mm-hmm. but it is settled. And
other
has,
people live there.
Yeah, other people live there.
These jerks.
And yeah. and these whites are kind of tasked with like going through and like kind of just taking it all.
Yeah.
You know, and like we have some really interesting, like these are like warfare stories mm-hmm. of marching around castles with the story of Jericho mm-hmm. to just demolishing cities and places, you know, there. It is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And especially it's God ordained.
Yeah. Because it usually involves an instruction by God to kill everyone.
Yeah.
Including like animals, including women, like leave no one alive, which is troubling.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's often a point at which the Israelites didn't do what they were supposed to do, like left some people alive or brought back some animals. And God then is often upset that they did not do what they were supposed to do. And so, yeah, there are some parts of this that are really challenging to read through and to sit with and to figure out what are we trying to point ourselves to here as opposed to just the violence within the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does kind of raise an interesting question. Like, is God commanding these people total destruction? Yeah. And maybe it is a little nebulous. There's other story. I got another story here. Saul destroying the Amalekites. And that is not up to debate. God is directly commanding Saul destroy everyone.
Yeah.
And that is and is rejected for not going far enough.
Yep.
Like that is real tough. And I mean, and probably if you want to think of the other, and then another big one in the Bible that obviously is not just God utilizing humans to drive, you know, to commit violence is the flooding of the earth.
Sure.
You know, a story we may have learned when we were children in Sunday school or VBS, because you get to put animals on a boat.
I do love that.
But it is pretty horrific, the idea that, you know, a bunch of people drowned.
I mean, if you ignore the people drowning, it's a great, lovely,
cool story
all
about
the animals. All the animals come on the boat. They're floating around, having a good time. There's a rainbow. Mm-hmm. Like, there's lots of good childy things. You just have to ignore the bodies. Let the bodies hit the floor.
Do you think more? Yeah.
I don't think the floor.
I think they float for the most part.
They sink eventually, right?
Yeah, I mean eventually.
But there's like gas and air and stuff. I don't know if you watched the Daniel Radcliffe movie about the corpse that he carries around.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
You should look it up.
He hates Ohio, so I'm out.
Daniel Radcliffe doesn't, but Harry Potter does.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
Yeah. So it's hard. This is hard. It's hard stuff.
I think one of the things that has been helpful for me in framing this, right, is the idea that the Hebrew scriptures in particular are trying to present a world in which humans are trying to obtain a purity that can allow them to be in the presence of God and with the presence of God. And God is trying to get them to that place, right? I mean, you had Adam and Eve together in the garden, and then Adam and Eve chose their own path. And it's not just like, oh, we didn't do what God wanted. It's an action that made them unable to be in the presence of God from a purity standpoint. And so, you know, the action of the flood is an act of decreation in God trying to repurify the world, right? If we read it within the context of the larger story, the act of going into Canaan, you can't be just a little bit pure, right? You have to be all pure or not. Like, that's the whole idea, right? If there's even just a little bit of dirt in your gold, it's not pure gold. And so the idea of going in and clearing out the promised land is an idea of purifying the land and purifying the people in the process. And it feels gross and icky to us because of the death and the violence that comes along with it. But it's the framework that they were using to try to understand how God was at work through their people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, what feels icky about it is the idea, you know, especially presented in the New Testament of like, God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Like if God is the same and the ultimate, you know, goal is what's presented in the New Testament. Like, why isn't that presented earlier? You know, I think it's a very reasonable question that I'm not quite sure has a very good answer. Just the same of like, if I believe slavery is like straight up evil and should not exist, and the Bible doesn't really call slavery straight up evil and should not exist, I think we kind of get to we're aiming to that point in the New Testament that we don't quite land on it yet. But why isn't it there in the Old Testament? Like at least why aren't we like really hitting those points home?
Yeah.
I think is really tough. You know, a God who loves all people is something I think is true. And then why doesn't God love the Amalekites?
Yeah, sure.
And I think that is a tougher question to kind of, I don't know if there's a good answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's okay to sit with I don't know if there's a good answer. I think that's an appropriate place. I don't know, appropriate. It's an okay and healthy place to be for a period of time, right? But there's also the opportunity for us to think, well, our understanding of God is always changing and always being renewed through the work of the Spirit, right? And so how are the biblical authors conveying their understanding of God as it was revealed to them at the time? And how has our understanding of God changed? And how? And so God is the same, right? God has not changed, but how have we changed in the ways in which we experience God and God's work in the world would be the question that I come back to that with.
Yeah. I think for me, it's kind of helpful to think about like what was going on in the rest of the world at that time too, right? And I think that there's so much that is lost just to time and like our understanding of these stories that if you were a native listener from that time period, that you would pick up on a lot more of the context and the nuance and the type of literature that you're hearing, right? And also, most of these stories are stories that are passed down from an oppressed people.
Yeah.
Talking about their shared history of oppression, right? And their inspirational stories that come from that, right? Yeah. And so there's a note of that too. It's like we're talking about stories from enslaved people at different times, right? And talking about their deliverance and their, in some ways, revenge, right? The ways that they've seen God move in the midst of their captivity. So I think that there's a lot of depth and a lot to be taken from them that I don't think is really surface level, right? And I also think kind of whenever I'm, you know, reading the Bible at all, but especially the Old Testament, I tend to think, all right, there's probably layers of humanity that have been placed by time on top of this, right? And then if you can like just be a little bit of an archaeologist and like dig a little bit, what is the truth beneath all of this that we're looking at?
I mean, even just, you know, the flood narrative, right? The flood narrative is in conversation with other flood narratives of the ancient Near East, right? So there's a Babylonian version, there's a, you know, all these other versions of a flood narrative exist. And so what are the biblical authors trying to tell us about some sort of catastrophic flood event, and how are they understanding that within their understanding of who God is and how God is at work in the world?
Right.
It doesn't mean that the story of Noah isn't true. It also doesn't mean that the story of Noah has to be exactly historically accurate. Like we could pinpoint this is the time and place of Noah. Like that, it doesn't have to have that for it to be true and for it to contain truth about who God is and how God is at work in the world.
It's like, you know, every religion has a creation myth, right?
Sure.
Like, and we also have a creation myth, and
we have a creation fact.
We have a creation story.
Two of them even.
Yeah. And what is it when you look at our creation myth next to other creation myths, like what sticks out to you, right? Like it is a very different story than other creation myths at the time. So it's that kind of stuff to me that I'm like, you know, I wish we had just kind of broader education on the rest of the world and what was happening, you know, and the Bible in conversation with that.
More people should go to seminary.
And we should all be in seminary.
And take intro level Bible classes.
Is that our advice?
I think that's it.
Step one.
I think we've covered
it. Go to seminary. Okay. You're done.
Yeah.
Seminary does not fix most of this, just to be clear.
Yeah.
I mean, I do appreciate, you know, that the Old Testament is presenting a world as is, you know, like, look, the Bible, the human characters presented in the Bible and the countries are at war. And like, that's just the reality. Like, and it's a close personal war, not like, you know, pressing buttons and drones do all the work, or a bomb gets launched and, you know, people die halfway around the world, but you don't know any of them and they don't know you. So like, but it is like a very like close war, you know, like, and I think that the Bible is obviously going to wrestle with who is God in the midst of a bloody and violent people in a bloody and violent world. And God is present in the midst of that, as he is present in the midst of everything. And so I can appreciate that, but I still acknowledge this challenge. So if you're like, I do not like this and it makes me feel uncomfortable, it makes me feel uncomfortable too. And I'm not quite sure I have a good reasoning.
Just like green eggs and ham.
But I also want to say this, and we'll get into now the New Testament transition point.
Okay.
Parts of what Jesus says also kind of make me feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's get into this. So this is Matthew chapter 5. and I'll read this here. This is from the Sermon on the Mount, not the Beatitudes.
The Beatitudes is the first portion of the Sermon on the Mount. Yeah.
So Jesus is on a mountainside. He's speaking for a long time, and they're writing it down and kind of giving, this is what we got. All right, and he is dividing up, you know, the new biblical authors have divided this up, but it's kind of like one stream of consciousness speaking. All right, and he says this in Matthew 5, starting in verse 38. You've heard it said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you to take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of the Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. We can stop there.
Yeah.
All right. So how do we see kind of like a clear difference here versus the Old Testament?
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems to be a much more explicit restriction on any sort of violent response. First off, response, right? Like, forget the idea of like a preemptive strike. Like, this is like, okay, someone else has attacked you first. And Jesus is still saying, like, returning violence with violence is not an option, right? Yeah. And, you know, one of the other things about the ancient world, right? When Jesus says, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, that was a law that was passed down through Leviticus, Deuteronomy, right? And that was a restrictive law at the time, right? It was keeping people from overreacting. So, oh, you took my eye, I'm going to take both of your eyes. And he's like, no, eye for eye, tooth. And so it was like restricting the ability to seek revenge. And Jesus is pulling that back even more and be like, revenge ain't it. Like that, we're not in it for revenge. And there's a lot that can be said, and maybe we'll get into this here in a little bit. There's a lot to be said about how this can be seen as passive resistance, how it can be seen as an act of rebellion against forces that are acting in oppression, right? All of that matters. Mm-hmm. But at its core, it's saying no violence, right? Yeah. No response. Allow yourself to be struck again. Give them more than they ask for, et cetera. That's really hard. And it's really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I think what always kind of strikes me about this section of Jesus's teaching is that like really intentional pivot away from like a law-based society, right? And a law-based way of thinking about spirituality to, I've fulfilled the law and I tell you this, and that is even more complicated than a list of rules.
Yeah. The fulfillment of the law does not make our life easier.
Right.
Because it's freedom in Jesus, in Christ, right? Mm-hmm. It's not freedom to do whatever we want.
Right.
And freedom in Christ looks a lot more appealing than perhaps it is. Which is not the right way to say that, but you get what I'm saying. Like, it's more complicated than we think.
Much higher calling than just saying, you wronged me, I wrong you back, we're good. Like, it's harder to say, you wronged me and we're good.
Yeah.
Like,
and you can hit me again.
And that's way harder.
Yeah.
Obviously, the big difference, you know, one of the big differences here is going to be Jesus is going to be speaking to like individuals as we kind of express, you know, figure out what it means for you to be an individual Christian. Much of the violence in the Old Testament is more on the national level,
sure.
You know, like much more, you know, tribe versus tribe, not individual versus individual. Not to say that doesn't exist. It definitely does. But like, it's just a little different. This is one of the things that always makes me wary whenever we're trying to mix like Christianity and the national level is I do think there are times that the state needs to should maybe act in differently than Jesus commands to the individual.
Sure.
Yeah.
By necessity of being a state. Like sometimes nation states should go to war with one another, and I think that may be the best option, even though I don't think individuals in Christianity should embrace violence.
Isn't there something to like the Jewish and Israelite way of thinking about faith and about kind of salvation was communal and also cultural at that time, right?
Yeah. Yes.
In the Old Testament. And so like that is very much the lens that you get all of that through. It's like we are all either saved or doomed kind of together, right? Like this is a very much a communal experience versus it shifts, right? And we move towards a more like individual understanding of salvation and spirituality later on.
Yeah, we definitely do. That's a kind of uniquely Christian take on it. And it kind of develops in Christianity and becomes even more strengthened in American Christianity later on. The other piece of this, Patrick, I share your wariness on this. I think what is always hard for me with like the nation state question of like, okay, when is it appropriate? How does a nation respond in violence or not, right? Is the way in which we often get gleeful about it.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that if we're following if I'm elected president, which is problem number one, something has gone horribly wrong, but let's imagine that I'm elected president.
Sure.
And I'm trying to follow Jesus as a president. And I, discover that Hitler is at work in Germany, right? Yeah, I want to go in and I know there's going to be violence. I want to be able to send our troops to help the people there because I do think that's a calling that Jesus has for us. And I think there's a part of me that should feel an appropriate level of an awareness of the sin that is involved in sending in people to violence, right? We can both do the thing that we know has to be done and acknowledge that it might be sinful. I think this is what is at the heart of Martin Luther's teaching to us to talk about sinning boldly, right? That it's not that you just, oh, I can go do whatever I want and do it boldly. It's like, no, you know you're always going to have to make hard choices. So you make the choice that is most loving at the moment and you repent of the things that come of it that are that you can't control, right? So, I do think, right, if you're a soldier in an army and you have to protect yourself or you have to protect your what's it called, people that you're with?
Battalion.
Sure. Yeah,
platoon.
Right.
Platoon.
Good words, yeah. Yeah.
Those are military things. Right. Right. If you have to protect the people that you're with, right, there are going to be times where you probably have to kill someone. And that, I cannot imagine that has to be an awful experience. Mm-hmm. I also think that it is a sin worthy of acknowledgement. Like just because you were protecting yourself does not alleviate Jesus's instruction that we shouldn't be doing. Jesus is laying out for us, this is what the kingdom of God is supposed to be like. This is what following me is supposed to be like. We're still sinners, so we still get that wrong. And that is okay, right? The forgiveness of God is ours. But Jesus is laying out for us what the ideal is, what we're aiming for.
Yeah. It's also always interesting to me to think about how Jesus didn't seem super bothered that Caesar was in political power, right?
Sure. I mean, like he didn't try to unseat him, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, it was not, the goal did not seem to be to have, like, Christian authority in political power. Sure. Like, that was kind of besides the point, I think, you know?
Yeah. But if we have Christians who have political power, I think we should be more willing to acknowledge the sinfulness that comes with that.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I think there are just ways in which they're going to have to make choices.
Yeah.
And there's probably going to be
not
sin
all
that comes
of
it.
Yeah.
Not all of them are going to be good.
And it's like the thing in
intentional or otherwise. Yeah.
The Good Place where, like, she talks about, like, oh, like, and I went to Earth and tried to make a choice. I got like a tomato and I realized that it was like exploiting all these people and there's like no good choice you can make. Right.
Sure.
It's kind of like that.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, when we think of kind of the Christians in the New Testament versus like Christians of today, like the disciples and Jesus have very little in common with American Christianity.
They would not know what jeans are.
Sure. Well, in state, basically just like having power in the state is just like something completely foreign to their understanding. Like they would probably find more of a kinship in like the Civil Rights Black Church, you know, kind of like as victims of the state and how do we persevere in light of oppression from you know those you know at the top of society
or the oppressed church in China or
I think that there would just be much more of an understanding or kinship attached to that. And so like how do we make sense when like we're the ones in power? It just becomes weird, like how to navigate these types of things, because the disciples in the early church don't have that mentality at all, and never the mentality of like, well, one day we will be in power.
Yeah.
And this is how we're going to do it differently.
Yeah.
They're not writing from that perspective. They don't ever think they're going to be in power.
Yeah.
Like that's not something that they ever think will happen. Rome is always going to be Rome.
Yeah.
And they're always going to be a kind of a subgroup within Roman system.
Yeah. It is interesting, right? Jesus does not say when you slap someone else on the cheek, right? It's when you get slapped, right? Jesus' instruction is as a response. And so there's almost, I think, an implication here that the only reason that you should ever consider violence, right, is as a response. And even then, Jesus is like, you should not consider violence, right?
Right.
And so, I think that as we are people who are in power now, like, how do we not only make violence a last resort, but make it a last resort after something? And people in America, we hate this idea, right? We hate the idea that someone else gets to attack us first before we do anything. And I get it. As a nation, that sucks. And it's awful. And I don't want to try to like get around that. But also, if you are trying to claim Christ, you're going to have a hard time claiming Christ in a preemptive strike scenario.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think what makes me uncomfortable about what Jesus says is I really don't want to do this either. Like, yeah. I may not want to live in the Old Testament where go to the Amalekites and like destroy them all kind of a God, and I'm following that kind of mentality. I also don't really want to live up to Jesus' ideals, if I'm being honest. And I don't think really many of us actually do. Like, most of us don't want to give our coat when our shirt is taken away. And I think that because I'm not seeing it. Like, you know, like in the reality, I just don't really see that from my Christian brothers and sisters. Really, we only see it kind of in the heights of oppression do we see kind of like this somewhat played out. And we don't, I don't necessarily think like, oh my gosh, I wish that could happen to me. You know, like, I'm sad that it happened to them. I respect their, you know, the civil rights resistance in the light of it, but I never think, I wish someone would turn the hoses on me and my family. I wish someone would release dogs after me. Or I wish I was not allowed to sit at the counter. You know, like, every part of American Christianity is fighting against those things. You know, like, that'll never happen to me, basically, is what I kind of see from American Christianity. And in my own even self, whenever I think of, in, you know, in our daydreams, in our movie preferences, in our books we read, I never want to think through the hero gives and gives and gives, and ultimately it's never satiated to the villain. I always want somebody to punch the bully in the face. That's what I want. That's the hero moment, not the hero gave more than what the bully asked. And because in the civil rights movement, we can say like they did it and they won through doing it, but sometimes people do it and they lose.
And I think people would debate whether or not they won.
And not every person in the civil rights movement lived to see a civil rights act passed by, you know, LBJ in Congress. Like, sometimes they just died. And they didn't get to see there's a goal in mind that we're going to reach. And maybe, we're still striving for those same goals. So I think that's what's the challenge. Because sometimes, like, I kind of want a God with the sword, as long as that God is on my side. And not a God who is willfully to suffer and ask me to do the same.
Well, I do think, you know, you had an interesting turn of phrase there at the end, right? I want a God with a sword. Like, what's the difference between trusting God with the sword and trying to take up the sword myself? And I, you know, even if we look to Revelation, right? Jesus comes with a sword out of his mouth, of all things, right? But the battle is already won, right? When Jesus shows up at the final battle, the battle is already won. It's already over. Like, there is no battle. There's no description because the battle is done. And so we do have a God who defeats all things for us. We don't know it in this life. And that is a very hard place to be. It's a place that we have to turn back to faith and trusting in the mystery of it. And that's not as easy as punching someone in the face when they punch me. Though I've never punched someone in the face. This is just a little moment of confession. I've never actually punched a person. So
yeah, me either.
I don't know.
Nor have I.
Maybe it's easier. I don't know how hard. I think we should both experiment right now, and we should all get to punch Patrick in the face and see how it feels.
Well, who do I get to punch?
You have to turn the other cheek. So
yeah, you're practicing following
Jesus. One of
us
will start, and then the other one will get the other
side. If you get hit in both cheeks, what does that look like? What, you know?
I don't know.
Equal swelling.
Technically, I still got two more, I guess.
That's right.
I think to wrap up, for me, how I kind of make sense of this is like, even though God, I do believe God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, I do recognize that God is choosing to reveal different aspects of himself in congress with history of the world. So like, there are different parts of who God is are being revealed differently. It's not a full revelation at the very beginning. And we just have that from the time. So Jesus is the most complete revelation that we get of what that is. And Jesus, I believe, and the early church is even giving us an arrow of, we're not there yet. Follow this arrow. Because we're not at true female-male equality at the end of the Bible. But I believe the arrow is pointing there. We're not at freedom for all, but the arrow is pointing that direction. I do see that arrow. And to say, like, we're not at, even at the end of the Bible, we're not at a world freed from violence, but the arrow is pointing that direction. To say, like, that, those are the ways that we are going to continue on as Christians, is by following that trajectory. And acknowledging that there's a tremendous amount of violence in the past, but that is, but we're getting a new trajectory into something new. And how do we step into that is, you know, maybe more nebulous, but
sure.
I think that is mm-hmm. part of what it means to be a Christian.
And nebulas are where stars are born. So there's that.
Great fact.
That's true.
If it's nebulous, perhaps we're all going to be a star someday.
A baby star.
All right. That's my science fact for the day. Hey, if you enjoyed this conversation, you can tune in at the beginning of every month when we take on additional hard topics from the Bible. Find all our episodes at beyondsundaypodcast.com and send us, you said something earlier. What were you sending us? Something that they were thinking about with the news story that we did? I don't know.
Well, if you have other parts of the Bible that I think are questions that I think are difficult.
Yeah.
You know, one of the ones I have like in my back pocket that I think we can talk about is like, what is the unforgivable sin? Jesus kind of talks about it.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. Patrick actually has a piece of paper that just says unforgivable sin in his back pocket at all times.
I look at it and like,
I don't know.
Interesting.
Still don't know what that is. So you can send that all to Beyond
Sunday Podcast. It's pineapple
on pizza. gmail.com.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week with more Beyond Sunday.